From 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. The word came down this week for former Attorney General Kathleen Kane, 10 to 23 months in prison for perjury and obstruction.
What's clear from this is that nobody is above the law. This is a significant jail time for the chief law enforcement officer of the state.
Kathleen Kane, the latest in a string of elected officials to go to prison. Before recessing for the election, Pennsylvania lawmakers approved bills to ease the opioid crisis, but fell short again on pension reform.
I can never think of a time where a governor wanted something, as he claims he did. He claims he wanted it, who provided zero votes. Zero.
We'll discuss that, and why is Pittsburgh's economy lagging behind the nation's? That's ahead on our weekly news roundup. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pennsylvania legislature wrapped up its scheduled voting days for the session, but with many major bills pending, what actually was accomplished? And the Pittsburgh economy is falling behind the nation. That's according to the feds. That's all to come, but first, Kathleen Kane, the first Democrat, the first woman to be elected as Attorney General of Pennsylvania, was sentenced this week to 10 to 23 months in prison for her perjury and obstruction convictions. We're going to talk about the fall of a rising Democratic star, the latest in a string of elected officials who were convicted or pled to charges. Joining us is reporter Katie Culinary from our sister station in Philadelphia, WHYY. Welcome, Katie.
Thanks so much for having me, Kevin.
And in studio with us is David Harris, University of Pittsburgh law professor and the host of the WESA podcast, Criminal and Justice. Welcome, David.
Good to be with you.
All right, Katie, you were at the sentencing. Could you start off by describing the scene? Her 15-year-old son testified, et cetera.
Yeah, and it was pretty amazing. I mean, I covered the entire trial, and I don't think I was in that courtroom in Montgomery County on a day that was more packed than on the day of her sentencing. I mean, the room was just, you know, filled to capacity with mostly a lot of her friends and supporters, family members who came to be there for her, as well as, of course, you know, many members of the media. But there were even set up extra chairs in the back of the room to accommodate a lot of her family and friends that came, many of whom also wrote letters of support on her behalf. And yes, as you mentioned, her 15-year-old son actually at the very last minute decided that he wanted to get up and testify and be a character witness for his mom. He seemed incredibly nervous and shaky as he got up on the witness stand and didn't say too much, but what he said was really poignant, I think, to a lot of those sitting in the room. He said, you know, my mom is my rock, and if she were to go away to prison, that would really be bad for me and the rest of my family. He has a younger brother who actually was not in the courtroom. Kane, when she got up to speak for herself, said that her youngest son just couldn't even bear to be there that day. So it was a pretty tense time as we were hearing a lot of these folks come up and speak about. At one point, Kane's 20-year-old niece got up and was in tears on the stand talking about how much her aunt meant to her and how when she was suffering from an eating disorder, her aunt Kathy had come down to visit her in the place where she was getting treatment. But it was clear from the judge's ruling that all of these good things that Kane did had been eclipsed, which was how the judge put it, by what she had done by lying to a grand jury in this plot to cover up this scheme to get back at a political enemy.
Yeah, I was also struck by the testimony of the 15-year-old child, not in a good way necessarily. I understand that the young person wants more than anything to not have his mother go to jail. But in my mind, some prison sentence was basically foreordained. I do not see how a judge looking at this case, knowing that this was the Attorney General of the state and she had violated some of the most important rules and laws of using a grand jury, stuff you just don't do. I don't see how that judge could not send her to prison. And I think the child was used as a kind of Hail Mary pass. Well, nothing else is going to work here, so let's put the kid up. I thought it was incredibly cynical when I read about it, and it was of a piece with the case, frankly. Nothing was ever about her. She didn't do anything, and I really didn't find this a very good example of what lawyers should allow to be done at a sentencing hearing. I was really put off by that.
Well, and then the interesting thing, too, was the contrast in emotions. While she was making her case and all her friends and family were making their case about her, you know, obviously the emotions were really running high. There were tears and there was a lot of, you know, pleading to the judge not to send her away. But when Kathleen Kane was actually sentenced and Judge Wendy Demchik-Alloy actually uttered the words 10 to 23 months incarceration, there was no gasp. There was no tears, no crying from any of these members of her family.
I'm sure that's right.
Which I think spoke to the fact that there was an expectation that she would be sentenced to prison.
No doubt. And if she had really been surprised, there would have been those kinds of sounds.
Right.
And the fact that just wasn't there tells you really everything you need to know. Everybody expected this to happen.
Well, and there was a moment, too, when I was listening to the prosecutors making their case at the, you know, at the end, it's almost like a mini trial because you hear the witnesses on both sides who come up and talk about what's been done or you know, give character witnesses to the person who's being sentenced. And then at the end, both sets of attorneys, the defense and the prosecution, get a chance to kind of restate their case for why they want the sentence that they want. And the prosecutors spoke about the fact that Montgomery County District Attorney Kevin Steele said, look, her driver, Patrick Reese, one of her accomplices, was sentenced to 3 to 6 months in jail. How could you not hand down a sentence of incarceration to the person who orchestrated the entire scheme? And that was the moment when I thought, well, I think we know what's about to happen here.
Now, Kane, as you mentioned, was sentenced to 10 to 23 months. David, I want to start with you on this one. The potential penalty was quite wide-ranging here. It could have been probation, house arrest, all the way up to multiple years. Why was there such a wide range of possibilities?
Well, the way sentences are determined depends on the statutes that were violated. Every statute will have a penalty provision in it. Sometimes it'll have a maximum and sometimes a mandatory minimum. So it depends on the mix of convictions that occur. That determines the range of sentences. So you had a wide range here because there were 7 different convictions for different crimes, and that meant that it was quite an open field for the judge. She could have gone all the way from a probationary sentence or a suspended sentence to one of multiple years. And so the question for the judge was never, I have to give at least this much because of the statute, or I can't give more than. She really had quite a wide range of choices to make, and she could craft the sentence in a way that she thinks would fit the crime.
So, Katie, was the prosecution satisfied with the 10 to 23 months?
Yes, I would say that they really were. They felt that it was a significant sentence and that Kane got what she deserved as, you know, being someone who committed a crime of this magnitude, literally breaking the oath that she swore when she was sworn in as state attorney general, the highest law enforcement officer in the state.
After the sentencing, prosecutor Michelle Henry said what Kane did was a disgrace.
She put her own desire for personal revenge above everything else, above the citizens of this state, above the hardworking prosecutors and the staff of the Attorney General's office. Everybody deserved better.
All right. So the public, everyone deserved better. You would expect those kind of comments from the prosecutor, but Judge Wendy Demchik-Alloy really let Kane have it verbally. Some things like calling her a political neophyte. Your children are the ultimate collateral damage. They are the casualties of your actions. This case is about ego, the ego of a politician consumed with her image from day one, and so on. Oh, this case is about retaliation and revenge against perceived enemies who this defendant felt had embarrassed her in the press. So to both of you, was this an individual rebuke, a scolding, up to the actual pronouncement of the sentence? Or is there any sense this might have been a warning to other elected officials in the future?
I don't know about a warning to others, but the judge is charged with kind of speaking about the significance of the sentence for this individual to the community at large. We use sentences for a number of purposes: to give people their just deserts when they've offended, to deter them from actions like this in the future, and to deter others as well. But here the message seemed very clearly tailored to the actions of this particular political figure, Kathleen Kane. And I think a strong rebuke was clearly deserved, given what she had done. And I think the judge felt that if she had held back in any way, that it wouldn't have been enough. I think we all remember fairly recently, we had a Supreme Court justice convicted in this state. And
Joan Melvin.
Yeah, that's right, Justice Melvin. And the sentence involved things like appearing in a photograph and writing letters to other judges and things like that. And I think there was a need for a strong statement that when somebody, especially somebody at the top of the judicial system, misbehaves in such a public and flagrant way, that this kind of thing simply can't be tolerated. So I thought the judge's statement was appropriate.
Katie?
Yeah, I mean, I think David really laid it out there, and the judge said as much as she was preparing to hand down her sentence. She talked through, you know, how she comes to make these decisions and all the things that she has to consider, like punishment and rehabilitation and the whole range of possibilities that she has for sentencing someone, as we just talked about before. But one of the things she said was, I also have to consider how can this sentence deter others who are like-minded from committing this crime. So not just looking at how it could deter Kathleen Kane from committing future crime. It's clear, you know, she'll never be a lawyer again after this, but, you know, how could she make a message to make sure that there's a deterrence for these kinds of things?
Prosecutor Henry again, she called Kane's crimes egregious.
Today, when she was taken out of the courtroom in handcuffs, there was finally justice. And I'm happy to see that this ugly chapter for Pennsylvania has finally concluded.
But the Kane chapter is one of many in the last few decades involving elected officials convicted or pleading guilty to crimes while in office. Senator Jane Orie, as we mentioned, Supreme Court Justice Joan Orie Melvin, Attorney General Ernie Priate about 20 years ago, Treasurer Bud Dwyer back in 86, Treasurer Rob McCord, he's still awaiting sentencing, Representatives Jeff Habay and Frank Gigliotti. From Bonusgate scandal, Representatives Bill DeWeese, Mike Vion, Brett Feast, Stephen Stetler. This seems like a long list of crimes committed while in office, or is this unusual in for other states?
Well, Kevin, I got to tell you, I'm from Illinois. I'm from Chicago. It takes a lot to impress me on this score. I mean, I had another reason to look at this the other day, and I saw that in my former home state, four of our last seven governors have gone to prison. Governors. And the old Daily Machine certainly had many people like that. So there's no state that has a monopoly on this. What's crucial is that when this occurs, it's taken seriously. There are real penalties for it. The public needs to have some degree of confidence in its government. We know that government can be a force for good, but we know that corruption is a human thing, and it's going to happen. And so we have to have wide awake authorities, prosecutors, independent investigators who will look for this stuff. And we have to know that those who are in positions of power, when they take advantage for their own accounts, that they are brought to justice. That's what we have to see. And so that's quite a lineup for Pennsylvania. But what's good about it is that at least those were ferreted out.
I know we don't know what was going through the judge's mind, but you alluded to maybe the judge sending a bit of a message, Katie. But I wonder if she had some of those names I mentioned in mind when she was scolding Ms. Kane and sentencing her.
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'm not really sure about that. But she did dwell for a time on not only the impact that this decision was going to have on Kane's children and all the people who'd packed that courtroom and obviously cared a lot about her, but also the impact that this had on the public. She came back to that a couple of times, saying, you know, these were citizens who were harmed by this crime because they are the ones whose confidence and trust she had broken and was completely, she used the words, it was eroded and undermined when she committed this act. And she said, the judge said that the impact of Kane's actions were pervasive and immeasurable. So I think she really also wanted to give emphasis not only to the impact that this was going to have on personal relationships that Kane has, but also on the public at large, the entire Commonwealth.
Another chapter still to come in this book. Former Treasurer Barbara Hafer faces trial now in April. It was delayed, or postponed, I should say, from December to April for making false statements to FBI agents about fees paid to a company while she held office and then allegedly received payments to her consulting firm after she left office. So it's not necessarily over.
No, the story of corruption, as I said, goes on. People should know that there's a statute out there that when you talk to the FBI, if you lie to the FBI, you can be prosecuted just for that. And it's amazing in how many federal cases people end up on the hook for what they said to the FBI when the FBI came to interview them. So just a little piece of advice here from your Uncle Dave. Get a lawyer. Get a lawyer.
And I would also want to add here, too, that the Kane saga really is not even over. I mean, we heard earlier from Michelle Henry saying we're glad that this chapter in Pennsylvania's history has finally ended. But, of course, she is going to appeal. She's got 30 days to do that. She can also ask the judge to reconsider her sentence within the next 10 days. If she loses that, she can appeal in Superior Court. If that's rejected, she can ask the state Supreme Court to take up the case, although that's not very likely to happen. But according to a great story in the Morning Call the other day, each of those steps can actually take somewhere from 3 months to about a year, so it could really stretch out the process. And of course, Kane's defense team has already said that they're going to appeal many times, and that a big part of that is because they feel like the entire trial missed another part of the story. We haven't even touched the Porngate stuff in this conversation. This idea that Kane was really the victim of an old boys club who was out to get her and are responsible for all of her legal problems. And so it's unclear what direction that appeal will take, but it is clear that that could really stretch out the process and make it, you know, anywhere from several months to maybe even a few years before Kane is actually serving out her sentence.
Yeah, you're right. The Porngate thing is a significant part of the story, and we shouldn't forget that it took down two Supreme Court justices, ended up resigning, a number of other public officials. It was very significant. The idea that that somehow excuses her conduct, I think, will never fly. Didn't fly in the trial, won't fly on appeal. So she's going to remain kind of in the halls of the convicted, if I had to guess. And whatever else happens with the Porngate stuff, it's a big black mark for the whole system. And hopefully confidence can be restored as time goes on.
Final question to you, Katie, and that is, you alluded to how long they have to appeal the sentence or ask for a reconsideration, I should say, of the sentence, and also how many days to formally file the appeal. Have we gotten any sense of when a timetable might be for hearing an appeal?
Not quite clear on that yet. Again, she does have 30 days to do that, but she also has this other step that she can take in between of asking the judge to reconsider her sentence and give her a much lighter sentence. And it's not clear which direction she and her attorneys are going to go yet or how soon that could happen. But of course, as with all matters of the court, things do tend to take time. And so I think we all still have to be patient to see what the next little bit of this saga is going to be.
So not a particular timetable as of yet, but in the meantime, Ms. Kane remains free on bail. She posted the bail Monday evening.
That's correct.
She does, yes.
All right. Thank you so very much to both of you. Katie Culinary is a reporter with WHYY in Philadelphia. David Harris is a University of Pittsburgh law professor and the host of the WESA podcast, Criminal Injustice. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much to both of you.
State lawmakers passed legislation to address the opioid crisis in the final days before the election, and the Fed says the Pittsburgh area economy is lagging behind the states and the nations. That's coming up on The Confluence, where the news comes together. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. State lawmakers met for 3 days this week, then recessed for the election. There are no more voting days scheduled before the end of the session, November 30th. Members of the House and Senate did approve several bills, but left some major issues unresolved. Joining us to talk about what was and was not accomplished are Karen Langley, Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Post-Gazette. Karen, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Katie Meyer, Capitol Bureau Chief for WESA and for all the public radio stations across the Commonwealth. Katie, welcome to you as well.
Good to be here.
If you have a question or comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. So the legislature had three voting days last week, three more this week before the election recess. Nearly 3,400 Pennsylvanians died from drug overdoses last year, 81% linked to opioids such as heroin, fentanyl. September 28th, Governor Wolf addressed a joint session of the General Assembly sort of to, I guess, rally the troops to pass proposals aimed at easing the opioid crisis. So this week, the legislature passed a handful of bills. First of all, any reason for why some of these ideas languished for many months? Was it simply the forced deadline? Karen, let's start with you.
You know, the legislative calendar and the different issues that they're addressing, whether it's the budget or something else, often, you know, dictate when bills actually get taken up. I think that that having had this major address by the governor in September and then now, you know, getting to the end of the session when it's the last chance for these bills to get through or else they have to start all over, I do think that that added to the pressure to go ahead and get it done. And as you said, we did see a number of these bills now on their way to the governor's desk.
Katie?
Yeah, I think Karen's exactly right. You do see, again, I think every legislative session you're going to see a large flurry of activity and, you know, people trying to squeeze these things in before they leave and go back to their district. So, yeah, it was just sort of a one after another package. We had five bills that went through, and there was one that did not. But, yeah, so it just end of session.
Okay. Let's talk about one of the bills that was passed that limits the length of prescriptions for painkillers issued in the emergency room. I remember talking to a sponsor, Senator Camara Bartolotta, when she introduced it in January, and she was pleased that it finally won approval this week.
Reducing the number allowed from 30 days to 7 days, some would like to see it less than that. You know, preventing addiction in the first place, because 4 out of 5 people addicted to heroin started with prescription opioids. It's destroying hundreds of thousands of lives, and we have to attack it hard. We have to attack it now.
So was the biggest dispute over this particular bill the length of the prescriptions, whether it was 7 days, 5 days, 3 days?
You know, I'm not sure what the biggest dispute was, but I think what you've seen with all of these bills is, again, we come back again and again to the prescription thing, right? So this is sort of where people have settled on as where opioid addiction starts. And so you saw this in every single bill that was passed, really. It was not every single one, but most of them, where they required healthcare professionals, you know, you had something like checking a statewide database before writing prescriptions. You had limiting prescriptions in the emergency room to 7 days. I think there was dispute over that, but it's just, I think, speaks to the larger attention that's being paid to, again, just how these things are prescribed.
Karen?
Yeah, I think like Katie's saying, you know, regardless of the specific number of days for the ER restriction, I think that there's an idea here that somebody should know how many opioid prescriptions an individual patient is getting, and, you know, which would also tie in to the doctors now being required to check the statewide database of the patient drug histories each time if they prescribe an opioid, so that, you know, it would be more difficult for folks to hop around to different doctors.
Yeah. Was there any understanding about at what point, I know you can't generalize, but at what point somebody can become addicted? And because the prescriptions had been as long as a month, I believe, from emergency rooms, was that part of it? Try to ease the pain, but make sure that it's, or try to limit people becoming addicted to the painkillers.
I think that, you know, there's the balance here, because you hear from the medical community that while there was support for some of these restrictions, that at the same time they were cautioning that you know, some patients, these are the most appropriate medications for them, and that they don't want to get a prohibitive restriction in there that, you know, doesn't allow doctors to prescribe this when it's the appropriate situation.
One of the other pieces of legislation, because you mentioned a few of them dealt with actual prescriptions, had to deal with doctors checking the database for prescribing sort of the drug histories every time. Was that mentioned as something that was very important rather than just checking the first time?
Yeah, I think that's just speaks to we want more oversight, or the legislature wants more oversight on these things. So, if you're only checking the database, you know, now and then, it's easier for things to slip through, for people to just kind of go under the radar and be prescribed drugs that they really shouldn't be getting. I think it's just, you know, increasing the amount of control that they have over these things and the amount of, you know, attention that's being paid to what people are actually getting.
So some of these bills were meant for, at least hope for, immediate impact of getting fewer people addicted to the painkillers, which we have seen can lead to the illegal drug use. But there was some also legislation dealing with longer term impact, or would take a while for it. And one had to do with medical schools offering courses on pain management and the risk of painkillers. Was that sort of a no-brainer, or did they get any pushback from medical schools that we're aware of?
I don't think there was significant pushback. You've seen a lot of these sort of education angled bills. You've seen them not even in just medical schools, but in, you know, elementary schools and high schools. And those have generally, you know, to speak broadly, have been less controversial bills that haven't seen as much argumentation.
Okay, one more on the opioids before we move on to pension reform. Was there a piece of legislation that was thought could get passed but didn't get passed? What are the chances of next time around?
There was one bill that had gotten a good bit of attention that didn't pass. It would have required insurers to cover opioids that are harder to abuse, so, you know, to give people more options for prescribing. And what had happened there was, at the last minute, some GOP lawmakers added sort of a last-minute amendment that would have required prescribers to hand out a pamphlet with every opioid prescription. The Pennsylvania Medical Society had opposed that part of it, and so there ended up being no final vote on it. I do think there are plans to, you know, resuscitate this bill and to go back to it later, but it probably won't happen this session, it's looking like.
All right. Katie Meyer is Capitol Bureau Chief for WESA and public radio stations across the Commonwealth. Karen Langley is Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Post-Gazette. Let's move on to pensions. Since lawmakers, they've been struggling with this issue of pension reform for years. And once again this week, House Republican leader Dave Reed said they fell short.
We got up to 99, probably the closest we've ever come on a pension bill that everybody knew was going to become law. We were three votes short. Hopefully at some point the governor decides he wants to participate in this process and we can get that done.
All right, Katie, go ahead. Finish your thought.
Sorry about that. So, yeah, I think it was a little bit of a surprise to House and Senate Democrats as well. It was a largely GOP-led proposal. So it went to, you know, a conference committee, and Democrats did not end up voting for it. And ultimately, there weren't the votes in the House and Senate to get it through because, again, there was no Democrat support. So, it was sort of, I think, something that the leadership in the GOP had put together. But it just ultimately did not happen this time.
Karen, did you get a sense of what was something that the Democrats couldn't swallow so that they couldn't sign on, at least a few of them sign on to this legislation?
You know, the Democrats who I heard from said that they had been cut out of the process of developing this proposal. And they, pointed out that there have been Democratic votes in the past for other pension plans, but they said that this particular one they considered to be a bad bill, saying that it would cut retirement benefits more than they thought was acceptable, that it would actually increase costs for school districts, and that it wouldn't cut this unfunded liability of the pension systems, which is, you know, our major issue here, any faster than the status quo.
So it looks like we're going to have to start all over again the next legislative session when it comes to pension reform?
I think that this will certainly continue to be an issue. You know, they would say, the proponents of these proposals would say that we're not starting all over and that we've been talking about this so much, you know, for years and are working from some of the same essential proposals. But I do expect that this will still continue to be a major topic of conversation. I mean, if you look at the costs to the state and the school districts, it's not going to, you know, fall by the wayside as long as so much of the budgets of those entities are being eaten up by the pension costs.
All right, let's move on to some other bills where there was action, or at least attempted action. A controversial one, a measure that would create rules about releasing the names of police officers who use force that result in death or serious injury. Debate on the House and Senate floors. Defenders said it would protect police. Opponents said it impedes transparency. Katie, so this gets passed, but any chance the governor will sign it?
Well, we don't know yet. It's been a controversial proposal. You've seen different positions on this from both sides. It's not sort of a partisan bill. And so the governor is considering it. He has not said he'll veto it. He also has not said whether or not he's going to sign it. And I think we will know that next week. But, yeah, there's been very little indication from Wolf on what he will do.
Karen, is there a difficulty here of balancing, you know, safety for officers versus, you know, the right to know the public?
That is the kind of debate that we are hearing. Of course, you know, this is a pretty controversial proposal. It comes during this time that the nation is grappling with these police shootings that have, you know, gotten so much attention. And so, you know, so certainly what we were hearing is about, you know, safety of police officers, the public's, and then the public's right to know when a life is taken or someone is seriously injured by the police.
Another issue that didn't get resolved, casino revenues. This legislation or attempt at legislation was forced by a state Supreme Court ruling not too long ago, Katie.
Yeah, so this has been a big one that I think we're going to see coming up much more in the next few months. So the impetus for some background, the Supreme Court declared a municipal casino tax law unconstitutional last month because it was effectively setting like different tax rates for different size casinos. And so the legislature was given a deadline on fixing this, 120 days, which brings them out to January 26th. So they were aiming to figure out a solution this session. It's going to be very difficult for them now that they have not this session to make that January 26th deadline. And so, yeah, there were a couple of different proposals that were floated, but none of them ultimately ended up being passed. There was a lot of division about exactly how to handle this and what else to put into the bill, because this isn't the only gaming and gambling thing that's been going on. There's also, you know, something about legalizing internet gambling that's been floating around for ages. There was argumentation about how, you know, what if they're fixing how the tax works, you know, they could also change how the tax is distributed. So you had lawmakers who were trying to get revenue for their own districts. So, yeah, I mean, it's a very fraught issue. So there's a lot of things that are pulling people in different directions on this.
Okay. But with the timeline, Karen, of what the Supreme Court gave them, I think we're looking near the end of January for this to be resolved, or the revenue department stops collecting the revenues, and that will also impact the city of Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. And in Pittsburgh, the mayor's chief of staff, you know, said that he was disappointed the legislature hadn't been able to resolve this, and that the city may pursue some agreement with Rivers Casino to get money. But as you said, this does put legislators under, you know, quite a tight deadline in order to prevent municipalities from losing this money. We have we do have the House and Senate scheduled to come back to Harrisburg in mid-November for leadership elections. They're not necessarily expected to take any big votes on you know, substantive legislation, although they have not ruled out any chance that they would. But it seems like we could be looking at a situation where they come back in January, and at that point are really under the gun to get this done.
All right, we have less than a minute left. What other piece of legislation passed or didn't pass that we should know about? Katie.
Go ahead. So there was one thing on alcohol legislation. The big thing that it would do, and Wolf says he will sign this next week, is change the containers in which alcohol can be sold by beer can be sold by distributors. And so we had only 12 packs before. Now you can sell it in 6 packs. It also lets bars open a little earlier on Sundays. So, and that was something that went through. The governor says it's going to get signed.
Okay, Karen, 30 seconds.
One high-profile issue that hasn't been resolved is changing the statutes of limitation for child sex abuse cases. That's, you know, a high-profile and controversial piece of legislation that I expect we're going to be hearing about again next year.
Karen Langley is Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Katie Meyer is the Capitol Bureau Chief for WESA and other public radio stations across the Commonwealth. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
After years of having a lower unemployment rate than the nation's, the Pittsburgh region's is now higher than the national average, and major industries are seeing weaker job gains. Is our regional economy lagging? And if so, why so? That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. For years, from the recession of 2008-09 until early this year, Pittsburgh's unemployment rate was lower, at times much lower, than the national rate. That changed in February, and now the region's jobless rate is higher than the nation's. To discuss the state of Pittsburgh's economy, we've invited Len Baselovic, business reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He joins us by phone. Welcome back, Len.
Hey, Kevin. How are you?
And Bill Flanagan is Chief Corporate Relations Officer for the Allegheny Conference on Community Development. And Bill couldn't completely eliminate his reporting background. He's the producer host of Our Region's Business on WPXI-TV. Welcome, Bill.
Great to be here. Thanks.
If you have a question or comment, please tweet us at WESA Confluence. So the region's economy lags behind the states and the nation in some key indicators, including the unemployment rate and job growth. Len, that's what you reported earlier this week, and that assessment came from the feds?
Yeah, they put out a beige book reports. Each of their regional banks assesses the health of their region's economy there, and that's what this report came from. Pennsylvania's unemployment rate is about a percentage point higher than the nation's, and we're also lagging on job and economic growth and housing permits.
So let's back up a little bit to both of you. The jobless rate topped out nationally, I believe it was 10% in October of 2009. It hit and was at 9.9% in April of 10. Pennsylvania's rate topped out, I believe, at 8.7% in April 2010. Pittsburgh's highest, I believe, was February of 2010 at 8.8%. Now, those rates have been falling over the years, but as late as December of 2014, the gap between Pittsburgh's rate and the nation was 1.2 percentage points, but 13 months later, Pittsburgh's rate was higher than the nation's. And in August, Lynn alluded to, the gap was a full percentage point, 4.9% for the nation, 5.9% for the Pittsburgh area. Okay, a lot of numbers there. So, Bill Flanagan, what happened?
Well, I think you can boil it down probably to one word, energy. And especially the natural gas industry. As we've looked at the data at the Pittsburgh Regional Alliance, which is one of the affiliates of the Allegheny Conference, a lot of the reason for the decline and the growth of our GDP and employment in the region really seems to trace back to the slowdown in the energy business, a related slowdown to some degree in manufacturing. There's also some trade issues as it affects metals manufacturing. And then that's had a ripple effect even into our financial service and business services industry, which is a huge part of our regional economy that we don't often talk about, but it's feeling the ripple effect of some of the other slowdown in the region as well.
Lynn, is that what you're seeing as you report on the business and the economy in the Pittsburgh region?
Yeah, the Fed cited particularly a sharp drop in jobs in Washington County, where they say has more active wells, oil and gas, than any other county in Pennsylvania as a probable explanation for this. Also, I talked with manufacturing industry people regularly, and all of them, you know, complain about how poor conditions are, and I think that complaint echoes from here across the nation. I mean, nationwide, manufacturers are saying the same thing.
Well, and we've heard it's no secret that we're still we don't make as much steel and specialty metals as we used to around here, but we're still a pretty significant producer. And Allegheny Technologies, U.S. Steel, have said that the impact of some of the foreign trade practices have really had an impact on their industry. They did begin to get some relief last year with some legislation in Congress and some favorable International Trade Commission rulings this year. So time will tell whether we begin to see some stabilization in manufacturing around here. But there's no question, too, the mix of manufacturing that we have here is different than the nation as a whole and different than many of our competing regions. So we may be feeling the pinch more because of some of those issues, because of the mix that we have here as well.
Yeah, actually, this week, Allegheny Technologies announced that they had idled a plant in Midland, in Beaver County, and one in the Allakiskee Valley, and those two plants, which employed about 600 people, they decided this week that they're going to permanently close those plants, and they cited trade, foreign competition, the same kind of things that Bill mentioned as part of their decision.
And the other dynamic is the slowdown of the natural gas industry, which had created quite a market for tubular steel and pipe years. And that a lot of that demand has dried up as well with the low price of oil and gas. So that's affected, again, the mix of industries and manufacturing that we have around here.
What I found interesting was that in August in the Pittsburgh region, the number of people with jobs, the number of employed, was down 12,000 from July. Was this a bit of an aberration? Because July was at, I believe, the highest number of employed in many years. So was this an aberration, or is this something, a portent of things to come with your mention, both of you, talking about the energy and then the closing by Allegheny Technologies?
Well, I mean, you have to be careful, too, about month-over-month changes, because
right.
It's really year-over-year, and you can because of all the seasonal issues that are involved. But, I mean, we've seen in the last couple of years a real shift. I mean, if you look at the energy industry, in particular natural gas, it really carried the regional economy through the Great Recession, and even if in its aftermath. I mean, Pittsburgh, if you look at employment change, from around 2008 all the way to the middle of 2012, outperformed the state, outperformed the station, the nation, outperformed competing regions. And then beginning around the middle of 2012, we started to track pretty close to the nation. And then in the period since, over the last few years, we've seen that gap widening in terms of availability of employment here. So the slowdown in the energy industry has a lot to do with it. And the other piece of it is the capital investment. From 2010 to 2015, we conservatively estimate that the natural gas industry poured about $10 billion of capital into this region, into southwestern Pennsylvania. That's $2 billion a year. So to put that in perspective, that's like a PNC Park, a Heinz Field, and a David L. Lawrence Convention Center twice over every year for 5 years. And that's a significant amount of capital that was pouring into the region sort of during the peak of that industry. And that activity has slowed as well. And all of that is now having a ripple effect through the economy.
Len, your story earlier this week, based on the Fed numbers, you cited that even industries that are growing nationally aren't growing as quickly in our area. Some sectors that grew nationally actually declined locally: manufacturing, government information and trade, transportation, utilities. You briefly touched upon that earlier. Would you expand on that, please?
Yeah, I think particularly steel. Bill had mentioned all the investment that the energy business had made in the region. U.S. Steel invested something like $500-600 million in a new coke battery out at Clairton. Allegheny Technologies, something like $1 billion at a new mill out in Brackenridge. So they poured this money into the region's economy here, but they're not seeing any payback yet because of the global glut of steel, mainly from China, plus slack demand. I think steel prices bounced up earlier this year, but have since August or July or so have started to fall back. So people are starting wondering what kind of numbers they're going to report for the third quarter and for the full full year, but I think, you know, from most of the people I talk to are manufacturing oriented, and steel is a big part of that story.
And we should probably also talk about population and demographics. I mean, one of the reasons why our region is underperforming relative to other places in the United States is we have virtually zero population growth here, and we have an older population. Both of those factors reduce the demand for services. And since a lot of the new job formation in any economy is related to service demand, the fact that we skew older and that we lack population growth here inhibits the region's ability to deliver employment there as well.
Well, Bill, I wanted to ask you, you know, everybody wants job growth, but is there just as much concern here, more concern about jobs that either currently aren't getting filled or might not get filled in the few years, several years down the line?
Well, I mean, I looked at ImaginePittsburgh.com this morning. There's 27,000 open jobs in the region. So clearly employers are having a challenge finding the right skills to match the jobs that are available. And then we know from a report that the Allegheny Conference released this spring, we expect 34,000 jobs a year to open up in the region over the next 10 years, mostly due to the retirement of the baby boom generation. So we have this odd dynamic where we have this outward this perception of this sort of lackluster economic performance, yet we see this increasing demand for skilled workers year after year after year for the years to come. And, you know, for those of us in the business of marketing the region for talent as well as business investment, one of our challenges is to let people know, you know, there's actually a lot happening here and there's a lot of opportunity here if you have the right skills to do the work.
And
there's also more and more programs, particularly at community colleges, to help people develop the skills that industry is looking for.
We have about 2 minutes left, gentlemen. I want to get to housing that Lynn mentioned briefly. So is this sort of a good news, bad news when it comes to housing? Housing construction permits are not keeping up with the national pace, according to the Fed, but the purchase price for homes are just about at the increases in purchase price, right around the national increase, about 5.1%. So homes are selling pretty quickly in this region. For the sellers, the prices are going up, but it seems like the investment in building new homes is not quite where it needs to be. Is that what we are seeing, Len?
That's what you see in the permit number. Now, people always caution about the permit number. Some people look at the sort of the actual housing start, saying that's sort of more of a accurate gauge of what's going on. I didn't see anything in the Fed report about the housing starts, but I mean, recalling the recession, home prices here, we didn't have the kind of disaster that a lot of communities like Cleveland had when the housing market fell apart in 2008.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting, too. We were looking at the growth rate, gross domestic product for the region, and we're lagging. There's no question. You know, our region's economy is not growing as fast as the rest of the country. But if you retranslate the numbers to GDP per capita, we're actually the top performer of the 14 benchmark regions we study. So we are creating wealth in the region, more wealth for the people who are here, even though our overall economy isn't growing as fast, which could help to explain how housing prices can continue to go up without the kind of population dynamics that drive demand for housing and multifamily and everything else you see across the United States.
Len, what are you working on? What are you looking forward to in continuing to explore the economy, the growth of the economy, or in the Pittsburgh region? What's on your table?
I'm continuing to watch the steel industry. I'm also interested in things like robotics and 3D printing, two big technologies that Pittsburgh has leading position in. And, they could be engines for growth in the region, but I think engines for growth doesn't mean what it meant back in the good old days of the steel industry when, building a plant and you're putting hundreds or thousands of people to work.
Len Basilevic is a business reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Bill Flanagan is Chief Corporate Relations Officer for the Allegheny Conference on Community Development, and he is the host of Our Region's Business on WPXI-TV. Gentlemen, thanks so much.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Kim.
And finally, what's ahead? In 11 days, Pennsylvania voters will elect a replacement for the now convicted former Attorney General Kathleen Kane. On Wednesday at noon, Republican John Rafferty and Democrat Josh Shapiro will meet in a debate at Point Park University Center for Media Innovation. Oh, by the way, the Confluence goes on the road next Friday. We will broadcast from the Center for Media Innovation.
And for this week, that's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer is Tom Hurley, production assistance from Vince Balestrino. The producer is Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.